Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Bob's Red Mill believes in baking, breakfast, and the pursuit of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carvin DeVito.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show brings the culture to horticulture. We Dig Plants is now on Tuesdays at 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, one whole hour Eastern Time. We also have a brand new format to devote to all things budding. Our show will also now be once monthly to allow us more time to devote to the research and the production of the show. We decided to have a theme running through all of this year, and the theme is land and climate. Our country is so big, and we have so much diversity within the people and the land and the weather. We wanted to highlight that by using the USDA map as our guide. Each show will focus on one USDA zone and the people and the places that make it unique. I love this music.
Let's pause for a minute. No eclipse is happening, but it's still very moving.
On each show, we will talk to gardeners, farmers, extension agents, botanists, writers, and growers who will reflect new, unique, and relevant ideas in each zone. We're going to share their stories with you each month and periodically on the blog, and maybe create a little zone envy in the process. So this USDA map is what the growers and the gardeners and anyone working in horticulture uses to try to determine what can grow where. It's a guide to your patch of earth. So when you buy a plant and you see that little sign that's stuck into the plant, that sign tells you the plant hardiness and the zone where it grows to help you decide if you can grow it where you live or if you have to bring it indoors for the winter.
So before we begin, I wanted to do a shout out to one of our fans, Noah Rattler.
Yay!
Noah gave
clap, clap, clap.
Noah gave our show a really great review on Facebook, and he has listened to all of our 200 plus episodes.
God bless him.
Yeah. And told us we inspired him to do research into African American gardening practices.
Yes. And Noah, I have a book for you that I'm going to send to you.
Yeah. We're going to message you. We'll get in touch with you.
We need your address.
Yeah. So on today's show, we discuss gardening in Zone 5, which on the USDA zone map is represented by the colors periwinkle and sky blue. So to discuss Zone 5 gardening, we chose two states whose areas are almost all within Zone 5. They're the two Midwestern states of Iowa and Nebraska, which also happen to share a border. So from a USDA perspective, they are blue states.
Very blue.
Very blue. But usually in the news, they're described as red to purple politically. So I thought that was interesting to think about color.
It's all about derivatives, right?
And what color means, right? So, for example, according to the website The Hill, the majority of Iowans voted for Democrats in 6 out of the 7 presidential elections, which was interesting. By contrast, Nebraskans voted for Republicans in 7 out of the 7 presidential elections. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this data is like totally unrelated to horticulture, but just thought that it was interesting.
Since we're kind of obsessed with blue and red these days.
Yeah, I thought it'd be interesting. So I'm going to think of them as blue states.
That's right. They are blue.
Yeah. So before we bring on our guests to discuss gardening in Zone 5 in their respective regions, we thought it would be nice to tell you a little bit about Zone 5 in general. It's divided into Zone 5A and 5B. So 5A, which is periwinkle on the map, the average lows range from negative 20 to negative 15 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yikes.
In Zone 5B, represented by sky blue on the map, it's a little bit warmer. It only drops down to negative 15 to negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
Will the real blue please stand up?
So I'm not feeling a lot of zone envy with these numbers right now. I'm in the right zone. Yeah. I'm in the top end of the cold zone. Also, interestingly, Zone 5 covers a lot smaller area than Zone 6 in our previous episode. But it does cover large swaths of the upper Midwest. And one of my favorite things to do when we do research for the show is to study the USD zone map and come up with cool places that are covered by the zone.
Right.
So, for example, the northern half of both Indiana and Illinois are in Zone 5, as is the very northern one quarter of Missouri. For some reason, just that little bit of Missouri is in Zone 5. Madison, Wisconsin, and the areas just south and east of it are in this zone. And that strip of land that separates Lake Superior from Lake Michigan, as well as parts of central Michigan, are also in Zone 5.
That's where my kin is from.
I know.
Northern Michigan.
That's right. They're Zone 5 people.
They are.
Now, out west, Zone 5 covers most of Colorado east of Denver, although Denver has its own little warmer zone. And it kind of swirls through parts of Wyoming and Montana as these kinds of like ribbons of warmth in these otherwise much colder states. So it kind of fragments. But then west of Boise, Idaho, Zone 5 is really fragmented as small pockets of cold in areas that have typically warmer winters. So
the mountains. It's the spine of the mountains.
Yeah. So there's some topography that really affects it in the west. Now, in the Northeast, I found it really interesting that 3 state capitals and their surrounding regions, including Albany, New York, Concord, New Hampshire, and Augusta, Maine, are all in Zone 5.
And Augusta's way far up there.
Yeah.
Really far.
Yeah. So it's basically the same kind of climate as Albany, which is much, much further south.
Yeah.
Also, the coast of Maine all the way to the Canadian border falls into this zone as well. And we can't talk about Zone 5 without mentioning Alaska, because although Alaska goes into the really low numbers, much, much colder.
Well, it's always temperate along the coast.
Yeah.
Right?
So the areas along the southern coast fall into Zone 5. So if you decide to move to southern Alaska, maybe you could bring your plants with you if you live in Albany.
Maybe.
Or, you know, some of them, depending.
Let's talk about light fall.
Yeah, that's a factor, too. So that's what I found really interesting about Zone 5 is that while it covers a lot smaller area than some of the warmer zones, it covers a lot of different topography from, you know, the eastern coast along the Atlantic to western mountainous regions, as well as the high plains areas that include some of our most productive agricultural areas. So while we are waiting to get our guest on the line, which will be shortly, Kelly Norris, let's talk about the eclipse for a minute. Because that, what I thought was great yesterday.
I was thinking about our show yesterday.
Yeah, because it covered a lot of area.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk to Kelly about it.
Yeah, because I think Iowa was in part in the path.
I had a friend that is from New York, and she went up to Winnipeg, actually, but then they drove down to Nebraska so that they could watch it. And she said it was amazing. They were in complete...
In Alaska?
No, Nebraska.
Oh, Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Okay.
So they had totality, and her pictures were amazing. And it was so incredible to be connected to that many people and to watch it, you know, in real life, but then also on social media, like what your friends were experiencing just minutes prior or minutes post. It was so engaging mystical, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the last time there was a full eclipse in the United States was in 1979. So
right.
It was pre any of social media, any internet stuff for people, for the average person anyway. And it was really, really great to share it at those many different levels, you know? So in fact, it was funny because, Beatrice, Nebraska was in the path of totality. And that was, something that we posted on our Facebook page that, you know, they featured that on the news. They had a correspondent.
Oh, they did? I didn't hear that.
And that was also the first, in 1863, it was the first land claim.
It was?
Yeah, Beatrice. So it's just kind of funny, like the worlds were colliding a little bit, you know? So anyway, if you guys have pictures of the eclipse from where you are,
There was a funny post from Maria in Zampini on my Facebook feed where she posted a tomato that had zinnia flowers out of the.
Oh yeah,
and she was calling it her tomato eclipse.
Oh wait, was that Maria Zampini? Or
I thought it was. Maybe it was somebody else.
Helen Yost.
I think
it was. Yeah,
I'm getting my shows or my people mixed up. Anyway, it was very funny and very silly, and I thought it was very cute. All right, well, we are going to skip ahead and try and get our second guest on the line right now. So thank you and bear with us.
Yeah, while we try to find Kelly.
So who is our second guest, and where are we going, Carmen?
Okay, so we were going to go to Iowa, but instead, right now, we're going to go to Nebraska.
See? Nebraska.
Okay. And
we're good.
We have? Okay. So today we have two guests from Nebraska, Dell and Alice Hemsath. They're both natives of Nebraska and graduates of the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Dell and Alice have taught many aspects of horticulture and agriculture, from plant propagation and insects to soil science and plant ID at the junior college level for years. And they're also very active in their local garden club, Soil Misters and Sisters in the Kearney area. But before we begin, isn't that great? I had to have them on the show. So before we begin the interview, I want to talk about garden clubs in general and the Federated Garden Clubs of America, of which Soil Sisters and Misters is a member. So the Federated Garden Clubs of America, or FGCA, are part of the National Garden Clubs of America, or NGC for short. And interestingly, it's one of the largest volunteer organizations of its type in the world. Founded in 1929, the NGC has 200,000 international members, 6,300 local clubs, and 60 state clubs, as well as a National Capital Garden Area club. Nebraska has a number of district clubs, and besides Soil Sisters and Misters, includes some others that have some great-sounding names that I have to share with you guys. The Gothenburg Gardeners, Spade and Hope Garden Club, which I think is really great, and the Dix Soilettes.
That's my favorite.
Which is the one that I would join if I was living in Nebraska. So the Federated Clubs of Nebraska have a long history, dating back to 1934, and a long, rich history of gardening and service. So to talk about Nebraska and gardening and garden clubbing, we have Dell and Alice. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you for jumping on and being flexible.
We
appreciate it.
And I'm an Alice too.
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. Well, we're on one phone right now, so we'll have to kind of change back and forth.
Got it.
Okay, so we'll just shout out and say, okay, Alice, you take this one, and then you put Alice on the phone, Del. We'll start with you. Del, tell us how you got started in horticulture and a little bit about your background.
Okay, well, I grew up on a farm in Nebraska, and that was kind of the seed planted in my interest in plants and gardening and those kinds of aspects. And I was privileged to be a first child to go to college in our family, so that was kind of interesting and neat. And in college, I studied about, of course, plants and soils and those kinds of things, and so that also heightened my interest in horticulture. And then when I got raised in a family, I wanted to plant a seed there as well with the children to get them to grow their own food. And so it just kind of progressed from there. And now I'm retired and busier than I was before. So you've probably heard that before.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, yes. So, Adele, how long has your family been in Nebraska?
We've been in Nebraska all our life. And so has my immediate family and my wife's family as well. So we are all Nebraskans entirely, except the earlier generations that came over from overseas, from England and from Germany, but that was obviously a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. So it's been many generations in Nebraska.
Deep roots.
Deep roots in Nebraska. So let's get Alice on the line. I want to ask her about what drew her to horticulture and gardening.
Well, I grew up in a family that believed in sustaining their family with their own food. So my grandmother had a large garden, and so my mother, my father had a large garden, and my brothers and I were the free labor
that
picked the beans and the strawberries and the corn, and we helped take the corn off the cob and help my mother freeze the corn, and then we help can the beans. And so we've been doing, it's always been there.
Were you also raised on a farm, or was this?
No. My mother was, both my parents were raised on a farm, but mm-hmm. my father was an county extension agent.
Oh.
So we lived in town when I was growing up, but we had like a lot and a half, so we had a huge garden.
I can imagine.
Yes.
And what about, so you grew corn and beans and...
The only thing that changed over time when Del and I started gardening was broccoli. My parents did not grow broccoli. Maybe it was just something they weren't familiar with, but I don't remember ever having broccoli until I was, like, in college.
Really?
Oh. But now that's one of my favorites. They grew squash, watermelons, pumpkins, tomatoes. My father had, like, 50 tomato plants and zucchini.
Wow.
You always had to close your doors when you saw my father coming.
And were you all involved in, like, the 4-H programs and things like that?
Yes, because he was a county extension agent. That was one of our childhood requirements.
I was going to say.
We didn't have a choice.
Right.
We had to be in 4-H. But I don't regret that because it gave my brothers and I self-confidence, and we all three of us went to college. And have been, very successful in what we've decided to do with our lives.
So, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a great program.
Oh, yeah.
It's so amazing to see kids
learn about it and have experience with it, especially these days,
Yes.
So
yes.
Kids are just so far removed from gardening and where their food comes from. And
right.
So let's talk about the landscape in Nebraska. You both have lived in a few different parts of the state. Can you tell us about the different regions in Nebraska?
Well, most people, when they drive through Nebraska on I-80, don't realize how diverse Nebraska really is. You start in the eastern part of the state, and you have the Missouri River, and you have the forested woodland areas along the river and the hills. And as the further west you get, in the southern part of Nebraska is very, you go along I-80, it's very flat because you're along the Platte River.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Platte River really means. It means flat.
Right.
In the Native American culture. And so you don't really notice that if you go like an hour north of where we live here in the middle part of Nebraska is the sand hills. And, I mean, they're hills. They're
mm-hmm.
not small hills. They're the only thing different about them is they don't have snow all year round on the peaks, on the, you know, on the hillsides.
But right.
It's very, very interesting and very, of course, it has the Ogallala Aquifer underneath, which is the water that sustains agriculture here in Nebraska. And then when you're further west, you get, of course, you're going from like 35 inches of precipitation to 10 to 15 by the time you get to western Nebraska. You're going from the Missouri River Valley all the way up to starting the High Plains area that takes you into the mountains. So western Nebraska is very different, very unique. It has a lot of pine bluffs and ponderosa pine. And so it's just different from east to west.
So tell us about the soil, right? Because I imagine
I'm gonna turn the soil over to Del.
Yeah, okay. Del's the soil expert. that's kind of his area.
Okay.
Okay, I'm here.
Hi, yep. Del. So soils in Nebraska. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay. Well, obviously, all states, of course, North America was formed millions and millions of years ago by a variety of weather conditions, being glaciers and seas and those kind of things, and Nebraska was very unique in that the western part of the state that Alice mentioned was actually underwater at one time. And so when you go out there, you see bluffs that have layers in there, and they actually have sea fossils of different types in those layers. And so that area is very unique. And Alice mentioned the sand hills. As far as I know and what I have been told, geologists really don't know where the sand came from because there's no other spot except right there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very, very unusual. And, of course, it was moving, shifting dunes at one time. And, of course, that whole area is sand-type soils. The western part of the state that I didn't mention anything about as far as soils is a little bit varied because of its past history and those kind of things. So you can't really say it's a certain type and that's the way it is all over, but the sand hills is certainly that way, it's sand.
Mm-hmm.
Then the eastern part of the state was actually covered by a glacier for a part of the time, and so its soils have a lot of clay-type material in it, and very, very different than the middle part of the state. And middle part of the state has a lot of wind-blowing material. So you just have a variety of soils going from west to east and also from north to south. So it's quite different.
And it's been intensive agriculture there now for, you know, a while, over 100 years, right? So how has the soil been eroded? What's happening in that with that regard with agriculture?
Oh, sure. That is one of the previous problems. Of course, the 1930s had the Great Dust Bowl Day and those kind of things. And, of course, that was erosion. And it all came from lack of knowledge and those kind of things. And so we really can't blame anybody. It's just, you know, that's the way it was in those days. And it just kind of happened. So we have lost lots and lots of topsoil. And, of course, there was at one time, supposedly, according to what they found, this area was, you know, completely grass area. And, of course, it had a fantastic root system that went down to 6 feet. So they estimate that, you know, the topsoil layer that we commonly call topsoil has been as deep as 6 feet. Well, it's not that way anymore.
No.
It's all down in the delta at the end of the Mississippi.
But, right, exactly.
But anyway, it has been eroded, but there's a vast conservation, you know, program with that. And every farmer in Nebraska conserves their soil because that's their livelihood. So they're very, very concerned about erosion, and they do everything they can to preserve it.
So other than the soil erosion, what are some of the challenges of growing in your region in terms of there's a lot of river systems? Is there flooding or other kinds of extreme weather that affects gardening?
Well, in that aspect, we're probably not much different than all the other states. We have occasional flooding that occurs, and of course, that's not good. Just recently here in Nebraska, we had some massive hailstorms that basically ruined the crops. The farmers aren't going to get anything out of the crops this year, and that's really, really bad. And also we have, high winds that come through, and that's a challenge for the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we're at the mercy of Mother Nature, and so that that really creates some problems, not only for your farmers, but for gardeners as well. So,
What is the major crop of Nebraska?
I would say probably corn is among the top.
Mm-hmm.
Because of our vast water supply we have, we are able to grow that crop quite efficiently. And so that's the primary one. In western Nebraska, where it's drier, they grow a lot of wheat, winter wheat, I should say. And then there's other spots which may grow soybeans and other variety of crops sometimes that, we don't think too much about. But it's quite variety, across the state. So we also grow, edible beans that you buy in the grocery store to make soup out of and those kind of things. sugar beets. Western Nebraska grows a lot of sugar beets. So the sugar you get out of the could be sugar beet. Could be from the south with sugar cane. But whatever. But quite a variety, yeah.
Whatever.
So what's tough to grow in Nebraska as shifting to gardening and horticulture? What is challenging to grow in the Nebraska climate?
From the gardening aspect, we have to time our plantings based upon the temperature. Obviously, as the spring comes around, it's kind of cool, and then the summer warms up to very warm, and then it cools off again in the fall. So we have to time our planting so that we don't get a early frost, which sometimes can, or a late frost, either one, which can hurt our gardening produce as well as the native or as well as the agricultural crops. That can be affected too. But cool season crops in the spring, those crops that require hot weather, like a lot of your vine crops, melons, watermelons, and so forth, during the summer. And then in the fall, you can also do a fall gardening here in Nebraska, which a lot of people don't do because they're basically tired of gardening by that time.
Yeah.
But it's an ideal time, actually, to do a garden because the temperature is cool. A lot of times you get some nice fall rains. And
we always say that, Del. We always say that to our clients and to other gardeners. Plant in the fall. Everybody's so eager to plant in the spring, and if it doesn't happen, then they kind of give up.
Yep.
You know, and they think they have to wait another year, and that's not true.
That's right.
Curious, what kind of trees do really well in Nebraska? My husband's from Kansas, and is not a lot of trees where he's from, but the cottonwood trees are the natives, and they do really well. What kind of trees would you recommend for folks to grow in their gardens?
Nebraska's kind of the same way. The cottonwood is actually our state tree, and it is obviously likes water, and it's along the rivers as well. But again, our climate is so variable, the tree species vary from east to west and from north to south. So the best advice for anybody that wants to have some kind of a tree in their landscape or whatever is to go to the local nursery and check out what they have, because they're not going to sell you, usually they're not going to promote anything that does not survive the area, because, that's bad for them.
So, right.
That would be the best advice because, in Nebraska, in the northern part of the state, we have a lot of pine trees of different types. In the eastern part of the state, we have a lot of oaks and other types of trees similar to that. So, it's quite varied, but oak trees are very adaptable, and they last a long time, and most people don't like to plant them because they think they grow slow, but it's a nice hardy tree and it'll outlive any human being. So
and very adaptable too.
Yes.
So another question, Del, is you've lived in Nebraska for a long time. Have you seen and you obviously pay a lot of attention to the weather. Have you seen the weather patterns change at all since you started gardening and farming?
Well, that's kind of hard to assess, but, you know...
Even anecdotally, just your, you know...
Yeah, many, many years ago, I remember, you know, blizzards in the wintertime were just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of snow and those kind of things. Well, we haven't had much of that recently.
Really?
So I don't know if that's because of just the change in weather pattern or if it, you know, is an overall climate thing or what. I don't know.
But, mm-hmm.
but other than that, we just, being in Nebraska, we just get very unusual situations sometimes because we get cold weather from the north that we can have a frost at the end of May. We can have frost in June. Frosts or killing temperatures can come in September. Other years, we don't have those. So,
yeah.
You know, you just can't plan. You just do it and hope for the best.
Just like the pioneers.
Yeah, right? That's exactly right.
So let's talk about the Garden Club, the Soil Sisters and Misters. Like all garden clubs, pretty much completely volunteer-run organization. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your membership and who they are and the work that you all do in the community?
Sure, yes. Our membership varies a little bit, but we're pretty fortunate in the Kearney area to have about 28 members in our club, which is pretty good. And we have a meeting once a month, and at those meetings we have either educational programs or we have other kinds of activities revolving around gardening in some way. In the community, we're very involved in the community with different kinds of activities. We take care of the landscape or the gardens at what's called the G.W. Frank Museum, the Women's Club, which is all over the country as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we have in the past helped with the Native American gardens at our Archway Monument, which is here in Kearney. But that has kind of moved around, but there still are some people that help with that, and that's an entirely different story as well.
Wait, well, tell us about that.
We help at the county fair and the horticulture division.
Okay.
We organize community garden walks as we want to promote gardening and those kind of things. We also recognize gardens in the community with our Garden Gate Award.
Oh.
And we also do different kinds of things, promoting education for our members through landscape study schools, gardening schools, flower show schools, and various kinds of other things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we became involved with children. We have a summer program here in the Kearney area for kids during the summer so that they don't just sit at home and do nothing. They actually learn a little bit during the summer, and so we have been working with them in gardens, and that's a fun project. We work with the second and third graders usually, and so that gets them started. So.
That's a great age. They're very willing and eager.
Yep. Yeah.
So it's called Soil Sisters and Misters, so I'm guessing that it's a pretty even mix of men and women. Is that true?
Well, I wish it was, yeah. But it isn't so much so, but we try to promote that because, gardening is more than just for the woman. It's for the man, too.
Yeah.
And so we try to promote that. And so in our club, we have a lot of husband-wife members.
That's great.
And other clubs have kind of copied our aspect, too, and they have male members as well, which is, very, very good. So we
I think it's great.
That.
I mean, my parents both are big gardeners. They grew up on farms, and they each have their sort of designated area. You were saying to me that Alice is kind of more in charge of the vegetables and the edibles, and you do more of the ornamentals and the flowers.
No, it's the other way around.
Oh, you're the vegetable man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Alice does. So I think it's great because Alice and I found when we in New York it was all lady garden clubs, you know.
Yeah.
And and that's great, but it's kind of nice to have the other side of it too.
Yeah, we go to the National Garden Club meetings a year, and I notice that too because I'm there. So.
Yeah,
I kind of look around to find other gentlemen.
That's good. And are new members coming in to the club? Are you it's great to get the kids in early and learning, and maybe down the road they can.
But are you getting any like millennials,
the 20 and 30 year olds joining?
Yeah, we wish we would, but, you know, it's a problem with all clubs. The generation that has the family, they just don't have time to get involved with outside activities.
Right.
So most of our members are retired or have just part-time work, or it's, in this case, the wife lives at home and the husband works or whatever. So.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's very, very difficult, but there are some clubs across the nation that sponsor youth groups or youth clubs, and, you know, we try, but, again, they're so swamped with activities, it's just you know, it's hard.
Right.
It's
hard. Yeah.
It's a challenge.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we've come to running out of time, but I did want to ask you about... places to visit in Nebraska. We talked a little bit about how diverse the landscapes are. Can you make a couple of recommendations to our listeners of unique landscapes or parks or gardens that they should visit if they're coming to Nebraska?
Sure. If they want to come to Nebraska to visit some kind of a landscape or business that promotes that, the Lorenzen Botanical Garden is in Omaha, and they have a huge facility with all kinds of things there, not just plants, but other kinds of gardening decorations and so forth.
Okay.
And we go there at least once a year just to see what they got and to shop a little bit, so it's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So they can Google that. I'm sure they'll find it on the web and so forth. It's the Lorenzen. I don't even know how you spell it, but Lurtzen.
Okay. Lorenzen. Okay.
Got it.
Yeah, botanical garden. So that's a good one for that type of thing. As far as different kind of things to see when you come into Nebraska, obviously we have some national monuments in the state. We have a Chimney Rock, which, of course, has a lot of history to it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the Sand Hills of Nebraska was designated in 1984 as the National Natural Landmark, which is kind of interesting. So if they want to drive through the Sand Hills to see what the native grasses look like, they can take Highway 2, which goes through Nebraska and kind of meanders through the Sand Hills, and they can spend a month there and not see everything.
Wow.
Wonderful. Yeah.
It sounds like a very interesting, maybe on my next trip to Kansas, I'll go up to Nebraska.
Yeah.
And there's also the Daniel Freeman site, right? The Homestead National Monument of America is in Beatrice, Nebraska.
Yes. Yes.
Which is really cool. That's where Daniel Freeman filed his claim 10 minutes after midnight at the land office.
The first one.
He was the first one to file
a
claim.
That's an interesting site. Plus, in that general area is the statewide arboretum. Nebraska is known as the tree planting state, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in Nebraska is the arboretum site, Arbor Day site and those kind of things, and so that's a stopping point too, and they have lots and lots of things there to see.
Well, that sounds great. Well, I think people should
that's
add
in Nebraska City is where that's
Nebraska
at.
City.
Yeah.
Well, Dill, thank you so much for being on the show. How can people get in touch with your garden club if they are in the area, want to find out more, if they want to join?
We do have a website, and so if they just Google Soils Sisters and Misters, the website will show up, and they can find more information by looking at that, and hopefully the person that takes care of that's keeping it up to date. She's very good at that. So
Good. Well, thank Alice for being on the show with us, too. Thank you for taking the time and jumping in short notice, and keep on gardening.
Oh, well, thank you, and I'm glad you guys are doing this type of thing. That's very important and very wonderful.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to have Kelly Norris on our show from Iowa. Stay on the line.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
I'm Mike Colomeco, host of Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm here with Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill, as well as Ray and Tom Williams, who've worked with Bob for years and co-own an organic farm in eastern Oregon and Washington. Ray, Tom, why is organic farming so important to your family?
It's all a matter of the soil is a source of nutrients. You increase organic matter of the soil, you increase the water holding capacity. Water is becoming increasingly scarce. So in terms of sustainability, we don't think it's the only answer, but it's one answer, and it's the answer that we're trying to pursue.
It's been a challenge, and it's been fun because it is different, and we're learning how to do it for the last 10 plus years.
We're not just doing organic, we're doing organic to high standards.
Bob, why did you choose to partner with Ray and Tom?
Oh, goodness. Well, because they're the best farmers in Oregon, and they're close, and they have a bunch of acres, I think about 10,000, over in eastern Oregon and Washington. They're wonderful farmers, and their family have been farmers over there for many, many years.
It's really important that you have long-term relationships, and we've enjoyed a long-term relationship with Bob's because there are a lot of challenges to organic farming. You simply don't have as many tools as a conventional farmer, and so you have to rely on longer-term solutions.
Knowing that you have a market is absolutely critical. The margins in farming are not that great, so if you grow the stuff and you can't sell it, you have a real problem. And we know with Bob's that we have a market, and we turn out high-quality grains, and they buy them, and it all works well.
Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We have Kelly Norris with
Yay!
Us now. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I blame it on the eclipse.
Everybody's so funky because of
the
eclipse.
I was out of it, typing wrong phone numbers and wrong times. Anyway, Kelly is a friend and a fellow plant lover and has been on our show before discussing his wonderful book, Plants with Style, which is available on Amazon. Kelly is an award-winning author and plantsman from Iowa and the first director of horticulture at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden, a newly revitalized public garden in Des Moines, Iowa. Throughout his career, his work has been featured in the New York Times, Organic Gardening, Martha Stewart Living, Country Gardens, Garden Design, and in numerous local and regional media appearances. Kelly is also the youngest person to receive the Iowa State Horticultural Society's Presidential Citation Award of Merit, an honor award in the organization's 150-year history, awards that exemplify service and contribution to horticulture in Iowa. Kelly, thanks for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me on again. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's nice to hear your voice.
So let's start off with an overview of Iowa in general. As a native Iowan and as the director of the Des Moines Botanical Garden, I'm sure you have done quite a bit of traveling around the state. And I think a lot of people from outside the region have the impression of the Midwest as a kind of monolithic prairie with no trees and flat topography. But from my experience traveling through the region, I can attest to its diversity. So tell us a little bit about the different regions in Iowa and how the landscape varies from place to place.
Well, I have a homeboy bias for sure, but this is a tremendously beautiful state. And of course, Tallgrass Prairie was a huge part of the heritage of this state. But you know, it wasn't all Tallgrass Prairie. In fact, here in Des Moines, we were in some ways kind of an interstitial zone between a more eastern woodland, eastern deciduous forest kind of ecotone that was more common in the eastern part of the state, and the kind of more Tallgrass Prairie dominant ecotone that was found in the western part of the state. So we sort of celebrate actually here at the Botanical Garden Oak Savanna in some ways, because that sort of interstitial zone between prairie and woods was actually fairly common around the confluence of rivers here in central Iowa, where Des Moines is situated and other cities downstream. So, you know, there's that kind of confluence of natural heritage in the state. But, you know, Northeast Iowa in particular is one of the great treasure troves of biological diversity in the state, because it was broadly part of what was called the driftless area. So during the last glacial period, this was the unglaciated part of the state. It was sort of a blowout of sorts in southwestern Wisconsin and northeast Iowa. So there's an interesting kind of, you know, moment of biological diversity there that isn't really found anywhere else in the state. So you were correct to describe, I think, people's impression. I think people think it's just one big flat, listless prairie, and we joke that's actually Nebraska. But no, there's certainly a lot of geologic as well as ecological diversity in the historic and, of course, contemporary landscape here today.
So you've been tramping around the state, botanizing, I'm guessing, quite a bit.
My whole life.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, I was a boy of the prairie. I mean, I grew up exploring native plants before I knew that there was anything special about them or that they were called native. They were just wildflowers in the ditch outside my house. So, absolutely. Yeah. I've spent a lot of time out in the wild in this state.
So tell us about some of the things you've found that you think might be of interest to other gardeners.
Well, the Midwest, obviously, with this great prairie heritage, and of course, you know, even within what defines prairie, there's different categories of different kinds of prairies defined by different plant communities. The Midwest is obviously has this rich heritage of grasses, and I'm a total grass geek. So, I mean, everything from big blue stems, which I'm a big fan of, switchgrass, Indian grass, those were kind of the big four that really dominated the principal composition of the tallgrass prairie. Across its variables, those were the most consistent ones. So, I mean, the heritage of grasses that we sort of celebrate so often in contemporary design today really owes its roots to the mid-continent of North America. And so, part of that matrix of plant material was also a tremendous proliferation of plants in the aster family, Asteraceae. This is one of the centers of diversity for one of the world's largest plant families, and there are many centers of diversity for Asteraceae around the world, but the Midwest happens to be one of those. So we love Symphia trichums, the North American asters. We have a number of species here in the collection. So today in the garden we have zigzag aster, Symphia trichum prenanthoides, which is a species that's all that common in gardens, and it should be more common because it's one of the earliest blooming North American asters, pinkish, bluish shades. And when the plants are young and emergent in the spring, the stems do have a sort of characteristic kind of zig and zag as they sort of snake their way to an ultimate height of about 3 feet tall at the very most. Some forms can be shorter. So there's great diversity in asters and Asteraceae. Vernonias, of course, are at high season right now. We love ironweeds here, so Vernonia baldwinii and Vernonia fasciculata are in full bloom right now, which is such a great complement to the domination of gold in the landscape right now. The goldenrods are coming in, the silphiums are just on their way out. So we love Asteraceae. It's a big deal out here. And from a natural heritage perspective, and I think it should be a big deal in gardens, and so we spend a lot of time getting people excited about those.
Yeah, and I think the Highline has helped here in New York quite a bit to promote grasses and these kinds of what people would formerly think of as just weeds, right? Weedy-looking things. So being that it is primarily an agricultural state and rural state, Iowa, do you find that gardeners in Iowa are a little bit more informed about soil and gardening practice than in more urban areas? What's your take on that, Kelly?
I think that's a very good question, and I kind of wonder sometimes if we're so much closer to the land here that sometimes we take it a little for granted. I don't know. I guess. Are we back?
Yeah, sorry. We were blaming everybody. We've had a lot of technical difficulties today, so we're blaming it on the eclipse, and that's that.
That's probably a good thing to blame it on.
Have you ever, Kelly? Did you ever watch Cheers?
Yes, I grew up watching Cheers.
Because when we couldn't hear you, Carmen started singing Kelly, 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 Kelly.
Oh, I used to have friends that would do that to me as a kid, and it was
mean. I'm sorry.
All right.
So before we lose you to the aliens in Iowa, tell us a little bit about some of the challenges for gardeners in Iowa. I know you probably have some extreme weather out there sometimes.
Well, I would say extreme weather is probably our norm.
It is
a mid-continental climate, and you know, we can go from having summer days that are 105 degrees to winter days 6 months later that are 25 below, and so that's just part of kind of our norm is the swing of the pendulum between kind of warm, hot, humid summers and cold, frigid winters, sometimes with or without snow cover. So I think that as we enter an era of more and more unpredictable weather, you know, it challenges our gardening a little bit. It really challenges us to think about resiliency in the landscape and what that means for sustainability.
Resiliency in the landscape. That is a theme.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Tell us about what you and the staff at the Des Moines Botanical Garden are doing to influence gardeners and gardening practices within the state.
Well, we really, you know, I guess I have a bit of a kind of a defiant attitude in a way of how we approach horticulture. I think it's a paradox for me that the Midwest is considered the breadbasket of the world. I think it's a paradox that we can tout the fact that we feed the world through our robust agricultural systems, but this isn't a part of the world that people think of finding great gardens in. And we have the same great soils that produce corn and soybeans and other kinds of, you know, agronomic crops and grains are the same kinds of soils that can give rise to really beautiful landscapes that are authentic, that really honor the natural heritage of the Midwest, and that celebrate sort of the contemporary styles that we love about modern horticulture. And so I think that's really the, if you had to draw all that out into some kind of Venn diagram, I think that sort of rich overlap is where we try and make horticulture. We try and really honor and celebrate our natural heritage, but we also really try and create gardens that have romance and emotion, that create some kind of response in people that makes them want to, you know, to be a part of the landscape and see it not just as a picture in a frame, but as an experience that you have to keep coming back for. And I think that's kind of our attitude, and it's also, I think, part of the culture of how we do horticulture here at the Botanical Garden.
To quit their coastal job and move to the middle of the country,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. No, I do. I agree. I mean, I think people, like I had mentioned before, my husband's from Kansas. I've spent a lot of time in the Midwest, and I find it so extraordinarily beautiful, you know, in its own super unique way. You know, I just love it. And I, even though Alice and I are garden designers by profession, some of my favorite gardens are ones where the people make themselves and really put their own imprint on it.
Mm-hmm. Of course, absolutely.
I think are the best. Well, to encourage people to come to Iowa, and to not just pass through on the way to the other coast,
or fly over, right.
Can you suggest some places for folks to visit that you think would be, I mean, of course, the Botanical Garden, but good examples of inspiring or unique Iowa landscapes or gardens that they can stop and enjoy and participate in?
Well, there's a lot of energy for public horticulture that's really emergent in central Iowa. So, of course, you know, us, the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden, but our neighbors in the community, too, the Brenton Arboretum, which is west of the city, which is an amazing collection that was sort of this single, you know, single-minded, driven pursuit of one man who really built this incredible collection of trees, kind of really just carved out of a cornfield. The Iowa Arboretum, even farther up the road than that, is a little more historic and storied institution by comparison, but has another great collection of trees with a young staff now that's injecting some new energy into that. The gardens on campus at Iowa State University in Ames, just about 30 minutes up the road, Ryman Gardens, is just at the precipice of some major capital improvements and changes. And so there's really a lot of positive energy, I think, in the greater region in tying together, again, this the realities of our climate and the historic nature of our landscapes, and really trying to place that in a kind of agro-tourism context, a horticultural tourism context, I think. So there is sort of an emergent scene of public horticulture here that's very exciting to be a part of.
Well, and what you're doing, I mean, the design capital projects that you're working on, because I stalk you, frankly, on Instagram. I've just admitted it. They are so impressive. Honestly, yeah. I really, really want to get on a plane and come out and see what you guys are doing, because I need to see that big sky and those big prairies. You know, we don't get any of that. And I don't even feel American.
That is one Midwest landscapes that's interesting, is that there is always a horizon to there's often a horizon to deal with, and that's something when I travel, that I see the opposite as you articulated it, because I realize I have to have that horizon line. I have to kind of see that horizon at some point. It's part of just how I'm wired.
We have to go to the ocean to see that.
Yes.
Right.
We're not
right.
far from it, but no. it's not quite the same.
But
and it's
that
not,
damn traffic.
I know. But it's also not 360 degrees. When you're out in the Midwest and you just turn around and you can see horizon in 360 degrees.
Right. It's, and the sky and the storms sky. Rolling in.
Yeah.
And like,
Plus you can drive, and I'll admit this publicly, 100 miles an hour, you know, which you cannot do. And I always have to do that when I go out to Kansas. I have to gun it.
Well, everybody needs a schooner, right? We all need a schooner.
That's right. My husband did try to convince me to, we did a big road trip this year from Kansas to San Francisco. And he tried it was amazing. And we certainly saw a lot of diverse landscapes in the process. But he wanted us to stay in, you know, in a covered wagon, you know, as part of it. And I said, no, not in 120 degree heat in Manhattan, Kansas. I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
You know, I'll do it in the spring, but not now. I'm a little
in the
bit,
rainy season.
I don't think so. Anyway, so you've started a new initiative, a brand new blog that I want you to share with our listeners at your new house, right? A brand new garden.
I am a new homeowner. My gardening life has been split for the last 5 years between the botanical garden here and my nursery at my family's farm, my Iris farm out in southwest Iowa, which is about 2 hours away from the city. And I finally took the leap this summer, just about a month ago, and dove into home ownership on six-tenths of an acre. And so it's a fairly fertile playground at this point. There's not a whole lot of landscape I'm inheriting. So I wanted to really create a project, and I'm going to do a 3,200 square foot meadow in my front yard starting next week, actually. And I really sort of, you know, this is a lot of, we talk about a lot of these principles of these sort of experimental principles in planting design and planting matrices and these very community-centric approaches. But, you know, one of the things I think that's missing is that we haven't connected home gardeners in a very literate way to that body of practice yet. It's still a little theoretical and a little academic for folks. And I wanted
sing
to try
it, brother,
and find a way to atomize
it.
That.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, you're the perfect person to do that. Kelly, because you have such good design skills,
right?
You know, so, you know, you've got the horticulture, you've got the design, and I think you're going to inspire a lot of people with that blog. So where can people find it?
Well, it's called threeoaksgarden.com, and it's in its very early infant stages. But, of course, the project is in its early infant stages. So I hope people will check it out and follow along. You can check out my Instagram. There'll be plenty of updates about the project along the way. So that's threeoaksgarden.com.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I'm glad we were able to connect. I'm glad we were
Absolutely.
Able to pull you back to Earth so we could talk to you for a few minutes. Before the aliens
got
you.
Yes.
And next time I'm out in the Midwest, I'm going to call you and I'm going to stop by and see how it's going.
You're both more than welcome. Next time you're out here, make a trip, you know, look us up. And the same goes for anybody else. We always love to show people what we're up to.
And let us know when you're back in New York. We would love to hang out with you again.
Absolutely. We'll plan on it.
Okay,
we'll do it.
For sure.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks.
Thanks, ladies.
Thank you for listening to We Dig Plants and putting up with all of our shenanigans today, electronic or otherwise, but we got through it.
Yeah,
we'll be back in September, mid-September, to do Zone 4. We get even colder. there won't be any eclipse, so I don't expect really any technical problems to happen.
But you never know.
You never know. The show's been written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please remember to subscribe to our blog, WeDigPlantsPodcast.com, or on Twitter at WeDigPlants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. You can also follow us on Instagram at WeDigPlants/GroundworksGardensNYC. Thanks for listening.
See you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.